Life's better with American Family Insurance because our home policies help protect your dreams and come with peace of mind. Save up to 25% by bundling home, auto, and life. American Family Insurance. Get a quote, find an agent at amfam.com.
Products not available in every state. Discounts may not apply to all coverages on an auto or home policy. Discounts do not apply to life insurance policies. Visit AmFam.com to learn how discounts may apply to you. American Family Mutual Insurance Company, S.I. and its operating companies, American Family Life Insurance Company, 6000 American Parkway, Madison, Wisconsin.
This is The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
They're running a strange program, y'all.
Now, here's Frank Morano.
What will be, I think, depending on how you count, day 8 or day 9 of the first Trump criminal trial. Now, in my experience talking to people about these Trump trials, whether they love Trump, whether they hate Trump, or whether they're somewhere in between on Trump, I get the impression, and I'm talking very educated people in some cases, I get the impression that folks almost stopped paying attention right around the time of the third or fourth criminal indictment. When it was clear, when there was only one case, when there was only one Trump criminal case, everybody was paying attention. When there was a Trump criminal case and one civil case, everybody was paying attention. Everybody could tell you every detail of both cases. But now that we're in a position where you have civil case after civil case, criminal case after criminal case, I get the impression that even very well-educated people, they just sort of, their eyes glaze over and they couldn't tell you what the actual substance of a lot of these trials are. What we're going to try and do for the next hour is declutter these. We're going to try to get to a point where we help you at least understand what the criminal trial that's going on now and what potential criminal trials might be in former President Trump's future. Because we really are, I know everybody says this, we really are in sort of unprecedented territory. We've never had a former president go on a felony criminal trial before. We've never had a major party candidate for president be in the midst of a federal criminal trial while campaigning. And this is a bizarre situation. So what we've done is assembled a panel of four retired judges who know the law backwards and forwards. They had different areas of expertise. They had different courts that they served in, different political parties, different ways that they got to the bench, different careers before they were judges. The one thing they all have in common, diverse as they may be in terms of expertise and experience, they're all pretty bright. A couple of them have been on the program before, and at least one is making his debut. Let me first welcome Judge Philip Stranieri, a retired supervising judge of the New York City Civil Court in Richmond County. He also served as an acting state Supreme Court justice, and he's the author of Filing and Winning Small Claims, Filing and Winning Small Claims for Dummies. Judge Stranieri, it's great to talk to you.
How you been, Frank?
Great. It's great. And thanks for staying up late with us, because I know you're on the East Coast. It's more of a burden for you than it is some of our California colleagues. I want to welcome as well Judge Herb Dodell. He's been a radio talk show host, does a terrific radio show called For the People. He was also a California Superior Court Judge Pro Tem and the author of the book From the Trench to the Bench, Navigating the Legal System and Finding Your Spiritual Path Along the Way. Judge Dodell, it's great to talk to you again as well.
Thank you very much. My pleasure.
And I want to welcome another Californian, a former presiding judge of the Superior Court of Orange County, California, former Libertarian candidate for vice president. He's also an author and a playwright, Judge Jim Gray. Judge, thank you for joining me as well.
Thanks, Frank. Always good to be with you.
And finally, a gentleman that is sort of hitting, is sort of wearing three hats today, because not only was he a retired New York City criminal court judge who served as the supervising judge for the Bronx Criminal Court and the administrative judge for criminal matters in Queens Supreme Court, so he knows his way around a criminal courtroom in New York City, but he was also a 30-year veteran of the NYPD, having served as the deputy police commissioner, so he knows his way from a law enforcement perspective around a courtroom. But unlike, I think, all the rest of us, he has actually been in the courtroom for a good portion of this Trump criminal trial, and that is Judge George Grasso. George, Judge, it's great to have you on the program. Thanks for joining me.
Great to be with you, Frank, and I've actually been there for every minute of the trial.
I knew we asked the right guy. I hope you're not billing by the hour as you might have when you were an attorney, Judge. Before we get to what's going on in Manhattan, I want to try to break down for folks a little bit about what happened with the Supreme Court. Judge Gray, I want to begin with you. What was your understanding, if you can, before you get to where you think the Supreme Court justices are leaning on President Trump's case for absolute immunity or some sort of limited immunity, can you explain to folks exactly what is going on? Why is this case before the Supreme Court, the U.S. Supreme Court, and where is this likely headed? What does this mean for the other Trump criminal prosecutions, Judge?
Well, Frank, of course, this is extremely complicated, and like you say, it's unprecedented. Bizarre is as good a definition as any. But I think the Supreme Court will lean toward trying to have the voters decide who becomes the president. They're going to lean toward not having a former president convicted of some form of offense, but it's complicated, and it's critically important that our country believe that the judiciary is not political. In fact, when I was a federal prosecutor in Los Angeles, we had it drummed into us, wasn't hard, that we will do the right thing for the right reason every time. And politics has nothing to do with it. Personal vendettas have nothing to do with it. You make a mistake, we've got your back. But if you do things for political or personal or grudge reasons, we're going to be held accountable. And we must get back to that. And we've gotten away from that. If people even believe that the Department of Justice is politicized or the FBI is politicized, very, very harmful for our country. And we've got to make sure, dead bang certain, that people believe that these are neutral institutions. And the Supreme Court, you know, they're people. They have their own biases, like everyone else. But I'm convinced that they're going to try to do what is right for the country under the law. But they do not want, they will not encourage, they will not support political prosecutions. And there's some reason to believe at least some of these are.
Well, but just so I understand, I mean, one of the arguments that I didn't think inured to Trump's benefit before the Supreme Court was when they were being asked about absolute immunity. And basically, there was a question about, would you be able to assassinate your rivals and call that an official act? I think almost every person, irrespective of politics or ideology, would say that the answer is, of course not. And you should be able to be prosecuted if you murder your political rival. How is there a case to be made that that's not the case, Judge Gray?
Well, certainly physical violence is going to change a great deal of things. But if you're going to get into Mr. Trump, who's certainly an unusual figure, and I'm not a Trump supporter, by the way, but you have to get into his mind as to what he intended, what he knew was happening, and whether, for example, you know, on January 6th, whether he really intended for people to become violent. You have to prove that first. If you're going to pursue him involved in a conspiracy, you've got to show the intent. You've got to show all these various things. And politically, you know, it's really easy to say, oh, he conspired to do this. He did that. But in a legal sense, you've got to be able to prove it. And I think that the court will stand up for that. I think that the court will certainly explain why these various things are and why they're important, and go from there.
Judge,
I think there's an issue that was raised was is there a difference between what he was doing as a candidate and what he was doing as the president of the United States, and that maybe they should have charged him that he was acting as a candidate and a private citizen when he was attempting to do whatever he was doing with the election, and not in his presidential capacity. That was a new distinction that I hadn't heard before, and some pundit had raised that this week, which is an interesting point. So if we assume, if we all agree that you can't agree to assassinate your political opponent, can a president assassinate a terrorist leader when we're not at war with terrorists? We don't declare war. Can you then be prosecuted for that by the next administration?
Well, yeah, particularly if there's an American citizen involved, as was the case with President Obama. Judge Grasso, I'm going to bring you in on this Manhattan criminal court case in a moment. But Judge Dodell, let me get you to weigh in on the Supreme Court aspects of this. A lot of people, wherever they fall on the political spectrum, whether they love Trump or hate Trump, there's some concern that if you grant a president immunity from prosecution, that it could lead to, I think one of the liberal justices referred to this as being a seat of lawlessness, where all you have to do is get elected president and you'll be able to break any law that you want. Is that a concern that people should have, Judge Dodell?
Of course they should have that concern. The problem is a question of definition. How far do you go? If you go to the far, far, far right, they're saying that the president could do pretty much anything. If you go to the far, far, far left, that's an entirely different paradigm. But the reality here is whether or not a jury is going to find the president, ex-president, guilty of anything. Now, I'm not a Democrat. I'm not a Republican. I'm truly a neutral. And I can tell you that under my 10 years on the bench, whether I like the particular litigant or not made absolutely no difference whatsoever, politically or otherwise. Now, the real sense is the examples given by some of the justices that were making inquiry really dealt with the degree of severity. And the reality is, I don't think that they can get a conviction if there's any ambiguity. One of the rules of construction in the law, civil and criminal, is that if a term is ambiguous, it's applied against one or the other particular party. And burden of proof is absolutely essential. And my feeling, there are political ramifications to all of this. I think a lot of this is political theater. I think it's just a lot of waste of people's time and money. And I think it is politically motivated. That wouldn't make any difference in the decision I would make. But I got to give this trial judge in Manhattan a lot of credit for his being so willing to be neutral. I think that given the circumstances and what I've seen in the indictment, by the 34 counts in the indictment, they're pretty much all the same. In fact, they are the same, except that they deal with different transaction numbers. So the reality is going to be, this is a very dull trial. You have a very intelligent jury, at least it appears. And frankly, so far, I haven't seen any evidence to support a conviction. That's just my personal view, and I don't know the whole case, obviously. I haven't read the transcripts, so I can't really say. But so far, I don't think the prosecution can make its case.
Well, let me bring in Judge Grasso. Judge, I've been very eager to chat with you because, as you mentioned, you have been there every day. And I suspect, unlike a lot of the other reporters, you bring a level of legal knowledge and insight to your observations that most of the other reporters don't necessarily have. Now, Judge Dodell referred to this as boring. This level of presidents, celebrities, money, and sex in one criminal trial, it seems the opposite of boring to me. Judge, can you kind of break down for us where we've been in this first full week of testimony, Cliff Notes version of what we've seen so far, where we're at now, and where we're going?
Yeah, great. Thanks a lot. It's great to be here. And I've been in total immersion with this particular trial. And I have to say, from my own point of view, it is the opposite of boring. It's probably the most fascinating case that I've ever seen personally. And I also believe, so we started on April 15th, and that was day one. I think Judge Juan Merchan is doing a great job, exactly what we would want. He's a very experienced New York City trial judge. He's called him right down the middle of the plate. But there's a lot of twists and turns along the way. So day one began jury selection. But right out of the box, you know, that got fascinating because before the judge could even start jury selection, he was confronted with numerous allegations of contempt of court from defendant Trump involving first the DA had three specifications, and then another seven specifications were raised shortly thereafter during that first week involving public statements by Mr. Trump to involving Stormy Daniels, who's going to be a potential witness in the case, Michael Cohen, former lawyer, a.k.a. Fixer, who's definitely going to be a witness in the case. And the judge had to set a hearing date for that. So he did that. And then he had a hearing. He hasn't ruled on it yet. It looks like the people's evidence is pretty significant. But then four more allegations came, and there's going to be another hearing on contempt this coming. I believe it's Tuesday at or Thursday at 9:30 a.m.
And just so I'm clear, the contempt is not necessarily the same thing as the gag order, right? The potential gag order violation?
Well, it ties together. The contempt is based on violations of the judge's gag order. There were two gag orders. The second gag order the judge issued to include the families of his family and the district attorney's families as well, although neither he nor the DA themselves are protected by the gag order, but their families are. And then, of course, all the witnesses and you know, the assistant district attorneys handling the case. So you know, this is like a three-ring circus. I've never seen a defendant who's been subject of so many multiple specifications for contempt. And the judge, because we have an unusual defendant here who, through the power of social media, can start tagging people and saying things about people and then potentially bring a world of difficulties, if not danger, to these people. So the judge has not ruled yet on the contempt citations. It's everybody is waiting to see which way that goes. The penalties involved could be up to $1,000 per specification or potentially up to 30 days jail. So that's one layer. So the first week was jury selection. The judge ended up seating 18 jurors, 12 for the panel, plus an additional six. So we have six alternates. And witness testimony actually began this past Monday, and it's been moving along. Witness number one is an individual named David Pecker. David Pecker is a crucial witness, and he spent about 3 days. The judge takes Wednesdays off. He has a mental health court. So we're not in court on Wednesday, but we are in court Mondays, Tuesdays, Thursdays, and Fridays, although due to Passover, we're not going to be in court tomorrow. So for a good part of last week, Mr. David Pecker was testifying. So we got direct cross-examination, redirect, a little recross, and then that his testimony was concluded. So he is the former executive and chair of an organization called American Media Inc., short as AMI. And the involvement of AMI and Pecker in this case is under the spear of AMI. He ran the National Enquirer. I'm sure everybody knows has heard of the National Enquirer. Basically, a tabloid, a grocery tabloid. So, the essence, the umbrella of this case is the reason for the 35 counts that was mentioned. It's 34 counts, I think. 34 counts are different documents that, according to the people in their case, contain falsified records that they are holding defendant Trump responsible for. Things like business ledgers and things like that. But most directly, as far as I'm concerned, to the former president, there are 11 checks. 9 checks were actually signed by defendant Trump when he was president. I believe it was in February 2017. This is all testified to by Mr. Pecker. The 11 checks are for $35,000 each. And they all went to Michael Cohen. And the purpose on the checks for retainer for legal services. Now, Michael Cohen was, in fact, a long-term personal attorney of defendant Trump. He was also colloquially known as the fixer. So the 420, they totaled $420,000. So with Pecker, to go back to Pecker's testimony, what we've seen so far in this case is that there was a meeting. This meeting is a crucial meeting to the prosecution's case. In August of 2015 at Trump Tower, according to witness Pecker, requested by defendant Trump, where the three of them, Trump, Pecker, and Cohen, met to discuss Trump's upcoming plans to campaign for president of the United States in 2016. The essence of what Pecker has testified to is at that meeting, Trump was saying essentially like, how can you help me? And Pecker, you know, Donald Trump, as most people know, but in New York, most people, I think most people around the country would know, as a younger, you know, he was always very involved in media and tabloids.
Sure.
Let's say he was never attention adverse.
Understood. Understood. Hey, Judge Grasso, hang on one second. I'm going to have to take a break in a moment. Before we do, Judge Trenary, you know your way around a New York courtroom yourself. I'm wondering if you can comment on two aspects that Judge Grasso just raised. One, the potential of a gag order violation. From your seeing of this, has Trump, in fact, violated the gag order? Also, Judge Grasso singling out Judge Mershon as handling the proceedings fairly. There's a lot of antipathy towards Judge Mershon from Trump himself and a lot of Trump supporters. Based on what you've seen in this case, is that antipathy deserved?
Well, I think this is, as everything with Trump, nothing's in a straight line. Everything is going around in different directions at the same time. Now, I haven't been, well, first of all, unless you're physically in the courtroom watching what's going on, getting your this either by reading transcripts or listening to the talking heads analyzing it is not the best way to do it. Judge Grasso being there has a much better sense of how the judge is ruling and how everybody else is behaving. And it seems that he's trying to be as straight as possible with the situation. The problem with, I think, the Trump defense of on the contempt orders is that, well, I'm not saying this. I'm just posting what Frank Morano said on, you know, on his radio show the other night about this. So why should that? I'm not violating your contempt order because all I'm doing is posting, which is probably might actually be a case of first impression on how he's going to rule on that. So that mm-hmm. seems to be what they, but the other problem is, and Trump knows he has followers that will take whatever he's saying as gospel and might act out in a manner which no one intends things to happen. But we, you know, because then he's going to say, well, everybody's their own actor. I didn't tell him to send, Judge Merchan, poison in his mail, but someone did it. So why should mm-hmm. I take the blame for an individual actor? But that's what makes this such a difficult case
sure.
to handle and to deal with on every day.
All right. Let me pause there. We're going to continue with Judge Philip Stranieri, Judge Herb Dodell, Judge Jim Gray, and Judge George Grasso. There is not a better credentialed legal panel anywhere in America, certainly not on radio. And by the way, if time permits, we'll try and get to a few of your questions. I don't know that we will get to them because I have plenty of questions on my own, but if you want to try and call in with a question, 800-848-9222. This is the group that can answer them. 800-848-9222. This is The Other Side of Midnight. Straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
Ohio, ready for some quick mental health facts? Let's go. Nearly 2 million Ohioans live with a mental health condition. In the U.S., more than 50% of people will be diagnosed with a mental illness in their lifetime. Depression is a leading cause of disability worldwide. So why are some of us still stigmatizing people living with a mental health condition when we know all of this? Let's listen to the facts and beat the stigma. Ohio, challenge what you know about mental health at beatthestigma.org.
It's The Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
Yeah, he, this court is now in session. His Honor, Judge Pigmeat Martin Poseidon. Yeah, he, the court of swings is just about ready to do that thing. I don't want no tears, I don't want no lies. Above all, I don't want no alibis. This judge is hip, and that ain't all. He'll give you time if you're big or small. Fall in line or this court is neat. Peace, brother.
Whoa, here come the judge. Here come the judge. Everybody know that he is the judge.
34 minutes after the hour, for this hour anyway, this is Here Come the Judges. We have, I won't give you all their credentials because we only have an hour. Judge Philip Stranieri, Judge Herb Dodell, Judge Jim Gray, and Judge George Grasso. Judge Grasso has the added bonus of being in the courtroom where this Trump criminal trial is taking place every single minute of every single day, and we're benefiting from his insight and his expertise. Judge Dodell, let me ask you a question about jury nullification. You know, usually when we talk about jury nullification, there's concerns that juries are going to acquit someone that's guilty because they feel, you know, whatever emotional factors are at play in their mind justify whatever crime they may have committed. One of the concerns a lot of Trump supporters have raised is that because this is a jury consisting of Manhattanites and Manhattan is not exactly considered a hotbed of Trumpism, that you could have a situation where, irrespective of what the evidence says, the jury comes back with a guilty verdict on everything just because they don't like Donald Trump. Is that a valid concern?
Sure. I'm a pragmatist. I was a prosecutor when I first started my career. I did a lot of criminal defense before I went on the bench. And I can tell you, all of this discussion is very interesting and very academic. But reality is reality. You like them, you don't like them. And I can tell you right now, this is supposedly an intelligent jury. They're going to look at the law. And the law does not favor the prosecution, in my opinion, from what I've seen so far. And the reality is you can speculate all you like. And I have had many juries in my career that have gone one way or the other based on what they felt about the defendant. Guilty or not guilty depends a lot on how they feel. And it goes without saying, jury instructions notwithstanding, just for your information, a jury instruction is what the judge tells the jury they should do in terms of applying the facts to the law. They don't always pay attention to that. I can guarantee you. If you look at O.J. Simpson, you look at some trials that came about, whether they're guilty or not, a lot of times depends on how people feel. And I don't think, when I said it was boring, you know what this case is about? Documents. You could talk about checks. This check, that check, or whatever. Whether the guy was intending to buy off potential witnesses against him, that's not against the law. Happens every single day of the week. And what's really interesting, to me anyway, and I'm somewhat conservative, but bottom line is, you look at the feds decided not to prosecute this guy. They had an opportunity to talk about election violations and things like that. They chose not to do that. So you look at why this prosecution is, and to take away from the legality of it, the reality, a lot of this is political. And I'm not a big fan of Donald Trump's. I'm not against him. I'm not for him. But the fact of the matter is, they're keeping him off the campaign trail for 6 to 8 weeks. And they're going to try to continue to do that. And Al Bragg, the district attorney, I don't know much about him, but the fact of the matter is, don't you think there's some political implications here? Of course there are. It's the same with all of the cases. Politicians do what politicians do. And if you look at the law itself, and I looked at the indictment today, as a matter of fact, I went through it because I knew we were going to be talking tonight. It talks about an underlying crime. I don't find any underlying crime at the moment. And I'm beginning to agree with a lot of the professors and commentators that unless you prove the underlying basis, you can't prove the subsequent. And the reality is, I think, bottom line, if these people are fair and honest and apply the law as I understand it now, without hearing all the testimony or reading the transcripts, I'm not so sure that the prosecution should make its case. A motion to dismiss might, when I say might, be granted. I would certainly think about it. We have it in California. By the way, I went to law school in New York, Brooklyn Law, and I'm a member of the New York Bar, so I have some sense of what goes on in both jurisdictions. But the reality is, after the people rest, a motion to dismiss might be granted unless the prosecutor has proved, at least there's enough to go to a jury, on whether or not there's reasonable doubt beyond the reasonable doubt. And you know what? I'm not so sure they can get a conviction. And the reality is, I don't care who lives in Manhattan. My son lives in Manhattan. The fact of the matter is, these are intelligent people. They're going to follow the law, maybe. And if they do, I'm not sure that the prosecution will make its case. That's just my outside opinion.
Judge Gray, when this case was first brought, even the New York Times referred to it as a novel legal theory. This clearly is not the kind of case that DAs are used to bringing in New York, or I think anywhere, regularly. It's sort of a first of its kind prosecution. If Trump is ultimately convicted, do you see kind of the newness of this type of prosecution? The novelty of it being potentially a grounds for an appellate dismissal?
Well, the answer is yes. It's truly unbelievable that this is the first time that something like this has happened with the characters, with the law itself, and there will be appeals. If Trump is convicted in any fashion, there will be appeals that go a long way, Frank. This is not going to just stop in the trial court. If he's acquitted, that'll end it. But otherwise, the answer is categorically yes, there will be appeals. It's complicated. It's amazing. But I do think that the judiciary is going to have to stand up and show with transparency how they are neutral, how they're going to apply the law to the facts of this case and explain, because our country needs this. And I sincerely hope and I anticipate that the appellate judges will do exactly that.
Judge Grasso, what are we in store for next? You mentioned what we're going to see on Tuesday regarding the contempt hearings. In terms of witnesses, who's next? In terms of prosecutorial witnesses and cross-examination of them, what can we expect going forward this week?
There's been a lot said about, you know, the potential viability of the case. So since I've been there, and prior to going there, I not only read the indictment, I read Judge Merchan's decision upholding the indictment. I was there for jury selection every day. I believe we have a very fair and impartial jury. And I not only saw them selected, I watched the way they're paying attention and they're zoned in on every witness. I think we have a jury that is more than prepared to give Donald Trump his due. Obviously, we have a long way to go before the jury gets the case. I think it's a very viable prosecution. It's not a boring case about documents. It's documents, but it's about, and the way it's been presented in the media, has this hush money case. It's not a hush money case. It's an election interference case. That's why I was speaking earlier about the crucial testimony of Mr. Pecker, because Mr. Pecker has testified. It's in the bank now. It's sworn testimony that Donald Trump called a meeting. How can you help me? Three things with him, Pecker, Cohen, and Trump. Meeting at Trump's request. Well, we can do positive stories for you. We can do negative stories. And during the people's opening, they refer to this. That's when, you know, the JFK assassination stuff with
Ted Cruz's father.
Cruz's father, which is really bogus stuff. You know, crazy stuff. But most pertinently, that they talked about women. Stories could come out involving women. And Pecker's testimony is, under oath, I will be the eyes and ears of the campaign on this. And when we see something that could be potentially damaged, I'm going to go to to Michael Cohen. And Trump is going along with the whole thing. That's August of 2015. That's when a doorman comes in, and Mr. Pecker has testified to this. There's a doorman who came in 2016 alleging that he had information. He was a doorman at Trump Tower, that he had information that Trump legitimately fathered a child. Then there's the Playboy model, Karen McDougal, talking about a one-year affair with Trump. She got $150,000 from AMI. The doorman got $30,000 from AMI with no to buy the rights to the story, so the story would never see the light of day. That's the kill part of Catch and Kill. And then in October of 2016, in the immediate aftermath of the infamous Access Hollywood tape, Stormy Daniels, through an attorney, approaches the National Enquirer team. Word gets to Pecker that from one of his employees that this could be very explosive, this affair that Stormy Daniels is talking about with candidate Trump. And he says, we can kill it for $120,000. But Pecker had been on the hook with the Trump organization Trump and Cohen for already $180,000, didn't want to pay all these back and forths. Cohen puts together an LLC, puts in $130,000, arguably, in the people's case at Trump's behest. And then a whole bunch of documents are created to cover up the payment. That's where those checks I was talking about for. And I know there's limited time. I could give you more specifics. But the essence is those payments, the $30,000, the $150,000, the $130,000, violate federal election law because they were done specifically for the purposes of advancing a campaign. They were unreported, and they significantly exceeded campaign finance laws. And then records were covered up. False records were made to cover those payments up. That's the bump up. That's the felony. Is it a unique case? Yes. But this is the first time, as I know, it's the first time in New York history, American history, we have a president, a presidential candidate who ended up becoming president, choosing to engage in this kind of illegal behavior. So whether or not this case will ultimately be proven beyond a reasonable doubt, that's a big open question.
The federal government decided not to prosecute.
Let me finish, okay?
The election commission didn't prosecute.
Okay, Judge, did I interrupt you?
Sure,
I didn't interrupt you. Please don't interrupt me,
Judge. I thought you were finished. I'm sorry.
Okay, I'm absolutely not. I'll tell you when I'm finished.
I'm not going to break out the gavel with you guys, believe me.
Okay, yeah, don't break out the gavel. But I don't interrupt anybody else, and I won't permit myself to be interrupted either. So, I'm not talking about that this is going to necessarily be a conviction, because this case still has to be proven. Well, in my mind, what David Pecker did is he opened the door to intent. The intent of Mr. Trump is crucial here. The door has been opened, but Cohen is going to have to go through that door. He's going to have to be seen credible to the jury. He's going to have a ton of baggage walking in the door, and I'm sure, and from what I've seen, the Trump legal defense team, led by a man named Todd Blanche, and there's another man, Emil Bove, they've acquitted themselves quite well, and they're doing their job. They're aggressively defending aggressively cross-examined Mr. Pecker, but having said that, I think Pecker's testimony held together. But as far as this case not being, my prediction is if there is a conviction, I think Judge Marchand wrote a very tight decision, and I think it would be upheld in the appellate courts of New York. I'm finished.
Judge Trenary, go ahead.
My understanding was that the bookkeeping claim that triggered this, that it was really election expenses and not legal expenses, was a misdemeanor under New York law, and the statute of limitations had already run on it. And that they then found that, they said, well, the federal statute, if we claim that you're influencing the federal election, is a federal statute that would bump this up to a felony. But that the U.S. attorney and the Federal Election Commission investigated this and decided they couldn't make a case and didn't go forward with it. And I think that's why a lot of academics think that this does not have a solid basis as a case, you know, that the whole theory there. I didn't read Judge Merchant's decision on the motion to dismiss, but again, on a motion to dismiss, you're supposed to read it right, most favorable light, to keep us, you know, and not dismiss cases on papers. It's supposed to give everybody the day in court. So it'll be interesting to see where it goes.
It's a cogent decision. You should read it. And on the federal end, they would not have been considering the New York bump up rules. And when you read Merchant's decision on this case, the people actually have three theories on the bump up. One is the federal election law violation. Another is a New York state law alleged violation where two or more individuals conspire to commit a crime illegally to influence an election either positively or negatively. That's the essence of the New York election law that's cited.
And then the third crime is another crime that nobody talks about. But it's sufficient also if the jury believes it. And that's a New York State tax law crime. Because I said that those checks add up to $420,000. They're $420,000 to pay Cohen back $130,000. So one of the things that they did with the bookkeeping is they added, Cohen said, well, I spent $130,000 plus there was another $50,000, some kind of electronic, I don't know if it was a wire transfer thing, but he got it up to $180,000. So then they doubled the $180,000 to $360,000. So Cohen wouldn't have to pay taxes on what he said he paid out of pocket for the Stormy Daniels story. And then they threw in another $60,000 for some kind of a bonus. Now, the people say, now this is all what has been argued so far. It still all has to be proven. The people say there are notes, like business record type notes, that they're going to try and put in evidence at some point that Weisselberg, the former chief financial officer of the Trump Organization, actually sketched all this out. So the numbers I'm giving you is what I've heard the people argue in court. But there are three separate theories that the feds in Southern District would not have had to consider in the context of whether or not they were going to go after Mr. Trump on this.
Thank you for that, Judge. Let me ask you to pause, and we're going to continue in a moment. Judge Trenary, Judge Dodell, Judge Jim Gray, and Judge George Grasso, straight ahead.
The Other Side of Midnight. Other Side of Midnight with Frank Morano.
All right, we are continuing on the Other Side of Midnight. I'm Frank Morano here with Judge Philip Strenary, Judge Jim Gray, Judge Herb Dodell, and Judge George Grasso. Obviously, the challenge when you only have an hour with four learned men like this is to get everybody in there and have everybody give their take on issues that sometimes require a lot of explanation. What I'm going to try to do, since we only have about 5 minutes left, I want to try and go through four what I think are relatively simple aspects of this case and sort of do a lightning round with each of you gentlemen and ask you all to weigh in on all these. Judge Dodell, do you think, I mean, we're all relying on Judge Grasso, who's been there every day to tell us what happened. Do you think there should be cameras in courtrooms in New York State and maybe even federally?
I agree, but I do want to make a comment where we have a limited amount of time. I have two words to describe the issue regarding the gag order and other issues, and they are, so what? It's not illegal to pay somebody off to buy their story. That's not a crime. And the reality is the feds, they would have investigated this thing up, down, one side or the other, because everybody's got a political motive. And I can tell you for sure that when you have a case that involves lots of documents, and I know from experience, jurors, the eyes glaze over. They don't want to spend the time figuring all of these things out. And the bottom line is, there's something called a hung jury. I used to say to people, if you can hang them, you can beat them. And I got my prediction is a hung jury.
Judge Jim Gray, you want to comment briefly on the issue of cameras in the courtroom?
Yes, I'm in favor of it. I think that the Supreme Court should have all of its decision arguments on camera, and I think that this should too. I think transparency is hugely important, and the judge can keep people from playing to the camera, but I think transparency is really important here, and I would favor this.
Judge Trenary, you never had cameras in your courtroom. Should you have?
Only to record my antics. Only in a case such as this, with all the implications, I think they should have allowed cameras in the courtroom on a regular basis. Maybe not, especially, you know, like in my court where people would probably think they're on Judge Judy and can entertain everybody. But in this case, it would have helped.
Judge Grasso, what do you think?
I think there should be cameras in courtrooms. And just in terms of what was just said by one of the judges as someone who was there, this is the least dull case I've ever been at. The jury is paying attention. It is not a dull documents case. And yes, while hush money itself is not a crime, spending money specifically to facilitate a campaign, hundreds of thousands of dollars, and not reporting it is a crime. Question is, do we get a hung jury on that point? I would certainly at this point be an agnostic about it. I think, look, the DA needs 12, Trump needs one. We talked earlier about, you know, what about pro-prosecution because it's Manhattan, which I don't think that that's overwhelming. I don't see it. But what about one person in that jury who might somehow be like, hey, I'm with MAGA. I don't care about the evidence. I'm going to go not guilty and hang the jury. That's a possibility. Two, if Michael Cohen explodes, if anybody's old enough to see the K mutiny, you know, Humphrey Bogart with the steel balls, if they get a steel balls moment and he blows up, I think the case blows up with him. So stay tuned.
Gentlemen, I'm going to have to end it there. My only regret is that I only booked you guys for 1 hour. And at the rate that you guys probably charge legal fees, I'm not sure I could charge a second hour. I would love to do this again. And we'll do this for a lengthier discussion. Judge Philip Schoneri, Judge Herb Dowdell, Judge Jim Gray, and Judge George Grasso. Hopefully we can all chat again soon. Thank you, gentlemen.
Okay, great. Thanks. Good night, everybody.
Thank you,
Frank.
Good luck to us all.
Welcome, Frank.
Thank you. We'll continue. We'll take your calls as well. 800-848-9222. Keep asking questions.
This is Greg Kelly for Priority Gold. What does it mean to be America's precious metals dealer? It means that you're in touch with the hearts and minds of those who love this country, value our freedom, and want to protect the future. Priority Gold is that precious metals dealer. They've helped thousands of Americans back their retirement with solid gold and silver. Call Priority Gold at 888-506-6439. Receive free shipping, free storage, a free investment guide, and one of the best purchase experiences in the industry. Call now or go to PriorityGold.com.